KBW Denmark, Green Bay's real news and great conversation, a Civic Media radio station.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. President-elect Donald Trump announcing he plans to nominate loyalist Kash Patel to be the next director of the FBI.
Kash Patel is somebody who has made a name for himself as the ultimate Trump loyalist. This is the FBI director nominee for retribution, and you can bet that there will be a lot of pushback, certainly from Democrats, but I think you're going to see significant pushback from at least some Republicans as well.
ABC's Jonathan Carl. Lake effect snow blanketing parts of the U.S. during the busy holiday travel weekend. At least five states issuing winter alerts, with some parts of Pennsylvania, Ohio, and New York expecting to see as much as 6 feet of snow in the coming days. Stellantis CEO Carlos Tavares resigning today as the Jeep and Ram maker continues to struggle with waning sales. Today, President Biden, First Lady Jill Biden marking World AIDS Day at the White House displaying the AIDS Memorial quilt. This is ABC News. Stoffris. You may have noticed when booking holiday trips that it's hard to find a good deal on a hotel room these days. Experts say if you're right, hotel prices are up because Americans are filling rooms.
With Americans eager to travel, hotel prices have risen almost 13% since the pandemic, according to NerdWallet. And not only are they up, but services like daily housekeeping and breakfast buffets disappeared during the pandemic, and some haven't come back. But Sally French, a travel expert at NerdWallet, says in today's travel world, at places like Disney theme parks and in Hawaii, there is no longer an off-season.
Often there is only an on-season, and that results in some really high hotel prices.
But consumers are showing they are willing to pay. Alex Stone, ABC News.
Ben Wickler, chair of Wisconsin's Democratic Party, announced his bid to lead the DNC, aiming to succeed Jamie Harrison. Wickler highlighting his success, flipping Wisconsin blue, vowing to unite and energize Democrats nationwide. Dave Packer, ABC News.
I'm Lisa Hale with WGBW News, your news roundup in quick podcast form. You can find it anywhere at the WGBW website, wgbw.fm.
The Todd Alba Show.
Trevi Olson, senior advisor at the Lincoln Project.
We as individuals need to be far better in terms of getting the tools we need to have the conversations. You're never going to shame someone out of their political beliefs.
Yes.
You're never going to get them with talking points.
You nailed it. And I think that that's what some of our friends on the left don't get. And I think it's destructive and it's not beneficial.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Uh-oh, Brad's buzzed.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, he's starting with the woots. And now a speech.
I just want to say that friendship is about heart. Heart and brain. Who's with me?
Good thing is, he knows when he's buzzed.
And my brain is saying, when it's time to go home, somebody call me a ride.
Love that guy.
Me too.
Know your buzzed warning signs? Call for a ride when it's time to go home. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. Wisconsin lags behind our neighbors when it comes to wind energy. We rank 26th in the nation. We only have 10 wind projects here, but advocates say adding more would benefit everyone. Here's Judith Ruiz Branch.
Wisconsin has about 900 megawatts of installed wind capacity compared to neighbors that produce more than 10,000 megawatts. Experts say better wind resources in neighboring states and lower solar costs enticing the state to invest in other projects contribute to the lag. Wisconsin farms are also smaller than those in the Great Plains states, says Sam Denisky with Renew Wisconsin.
You can't just put two turbines right next to each other, right? The atmospheric dynamics requires a little bit more spacing in between turbines.
But Denisky says the state's wind potential is high. Some Wisconsin utilities have already added wind options to their portfolios, and all have set goals to reduce carbon emissions. At least a handful of wind energy projects are planned for Wisconsin in the coming year. Another challenge is misinformation, that wind turbines are noisy, negatively affect property values, or pose health risks. Denisky says most of those claims are not supported by scientific evidence. What has been proven, he says, is that wind energy is less harmful to wildlife and the environment than traditional power generation.
We have the potential here to do our own energy in our own state, to add great paying jobs like wind turbine technicians to the mix. And we also give landowners kind of like a lifeline in this aspect.
He adds farmers who have been hit hard economically in recent years could benefit from gaining an additional income stream by leasing land for these projects. For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Mostly sunny to partly cloudy skies as a few flurries develop in the afternoon. Highs in the upper 20s and northwest winds gusting around 20 miles per hour. Flurry chances continue tonight, partly cloudy skies, and lows near 20.
It's 24 at our studios.
Todd Albaugh.
Hey, everybody. Join us next time an all-new live show back in the studio. Join us for a look back at the holiday weekend and prepare you for the week ahead.
The Todd Albaugh Show, weekdays noon till 2. From Hobart to Bay Settlement, 97.9 WGBW.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel. In this, the second hour of our weekend broadcast, talking about all things related to the administration of justice in the United States of America and beyond, and in particular focusing in the next segment or so on a common theme here in our broadcast, that is the United States Supreme Court once again taking up what many are calling a renewed challenge to agency power in the wake of what it did the last term in rejecting this notion of Chevron deference, this idea that agencies know what they're doing, that expertise should be relied upon. No more in the wake of 40 years. Well, now we've got another doctrine called the non-delegation doctrine. It's been out there, at least in its non-application, following all those double negatives, are you? In its non-application, about 85 years. And so the Supreme Court primed, it seems, to reverse tradition that has been in place for 85 years or so. Well, now, what does the non-delegation doctrine say? Well, as we all know, the United States Congress is the entity in our government that passes laws, and they vest in the various agencies, including the Federal Communications Commission and all the other agencies over which they have some administrative authority and some constituting authority. They vest in those agencies responsibility for making decisions about cases. In particular, basically, the Congress is delegating to those agency officials, which, yes, have expertise and insight and experience, delegating to them the responsibility for actually implementing the broad principles of the legislation itself. It's a fairly straightforward doctrine. The non-delegation doctrine would be an attack on that that says, no, Congress cannot delegate that responsibility. Congress has got to implement, they've got to describe, they've got to effectively be in the weeds on all the particulars when it comes to applying the laws that they pass. So they cannot delegate, members of Congress, the Senate, the House, cannot delegate those responsibilities to the agencies. It's all got to be defined. Absent that, the agencies have no authority. And the reality is that this so-called non-delegation doctrine has been dormant. It has not been used. It has not been used by the Supreme Court, by the lower courts, the appeals courts, the district courts, since 1935 or so, when the Supreme Court was striking down some New Deal laws. Remember those in history? For granting too much leeway to agencies with insufficient guidance. It has been dormant since that time. Basically, an affirmation since 1935 that, yes, indeed, agencies know what they're doing. And they can, in fact, act reasonably in the wake of delegations to them by the Congress and authority vested in them to act reasonably and rationally. Well, that issue, that 85-year tradition, may now be on the chopping block. What do we know? Well, we know that the dispute that prompts this particular case, a case in which the Supreme Court has just granted cert
Certiorari is going to review this case probably for oral argument in the spring. Actually, two consolidated cases called FCC versus Consumers Research and another one called Schools, Health, and Libraries Broadband Coalition versus Consumer Research. Both of those cases have to do with an $8 billion with a B-dollar fund that helps pay for telephone and broadband services for impoverished communities, residences of our rural areas throughout our nation. It's overseen by the Federal Communications Commission. That's their agency. And the Universal Service Fund relies on charges imposed on phone bills. That's how it's funded. So again, this is an attempt to bring communication to the, bring the internet, bring telephone services to rural and other impoverished communities nationwide. Consumers Research, which is this group that's challenging the law, says it grants the agency too much discretion. And it also said the FCC has acted unlawfully in letting a private entity administer the fund, kind of a collateral issue there as well. The U.S. Court of Appeals, as I indicated right before our top of the hour break, said, yeah, they're right. The program is invalid. It's an inappropriate usurpation of congressional action. The agency, the FCC, cannot do that. It's unconstitutional. The Biden administration has asked the Supreme Court to intervene, and indeed they did just this past week. If left in place, the administration said the decision will upend the universal service programs to the detriment of millions of consumers nationwide. That's being said by the Biden administration in support of this FCC program now being challenged. And challenged in part upon the notion that the non-delegation doctrine prohibits the FCC from doing this. Congress cannot delegate to the FCC the authority to spend this money because it's not sufficiently specific. They cannot do this constitutionally, effectively seeking to revive, after 85 years, this non-delegation doctrine that the Supreme Court has not embraced at all in the past 85 years or so. And again, right before the break, commenting upon Justice Sam Alito's comment way back in a couple of years ago saying, you know, it's time for us to revisit this. Maybe we should revive the non-delegation doctrine once again because the agencies, maybe including the FCC, have been exercising too much power. It is, as I have commented in the past, it is another incarnation in the courts of this attack upon agencies, this notion that somehow we've got a deep state of people and experts who are doing things opaquely without our supervision, without our knowledge. It's ridiculous. It is completely unsupported by what practically happens in America. But nonetheless, it has taken hold in the political realm, and now it's taken hold in the United States Supreme Court. In addition to Justice Alito supporting this, three other members of the court, the Chief Justice, his name is John Roberts, Justices Clarence Thomas, Neil Gorsuch, have said that they were also ready to act right away. So we've got at least four of them, plainly, who said, yes, bring this case on. Maybe it is time to revive the non-delegation doctrine and once again strip authority from our agencies, including the FCC, to do these kinds of things. Yet another attack. Probably we won't see it until the springtime, but certainly a decision on this in May or June of or July of this coming year, 2025. It goes on. And the decision by the Supreme Court to continue to address that particular attack upon this agency, other agencies as well out there, is a subject matter that plainly remains on their docket. Also on the docket, of course, are oral arguments. And it is important to note that this week, this coming week, the Supreme Court back in business once again. Four different oral arguments. We know what those are about. Let's talk about two of them. On Monday, December 2nd, we know that there is a major case that we've talked about before. This is the so-called e-cigarette case. This is the vaping case. The Supreme Court is going to determine whether or not a lower court was right in its decision on a decision by a federal agency when it comes to approving or not approving the authorization to sell and distribute e-cigarettes. That's coming up this coming Monday. The vaping case coming up for the Supreme Court. Be interesting to listen to them. Again, you can listen to that live on the Supreme Court website. And then there's this other major case we've also talked about. It's called Scrimeti. And this is the transgender case. a major case coming out of at least two legislatures in our nation. And those particular laws, Tennessee and Kentucky, prohibit medical treatment for the purpose of attempting to alter, according to the Kentucky law, the appearance of or to validate a minor's perception of a minor's sex, basically prohibiting medical treatments that permit youth to begin to engage in transgender treatment, prohibiting that. And under a number of different circumstances, the Tennessee law specifically forbidding medical treatments to allow a minor to identify with or live as a purported identity inconsistent with the minor's sex, or to treat, again, this is directed at the doctors, to treat purported discomfort or distress from a discordance between the minor's sex, that, of course, referring to the minor's identified sex at birth, and asserted identity. In other words, stopping medical treatment, stopping puberty blockers, certainly stopping surgical procedures at any time for youth who are seeking transgender medical care and counseling, and certainly the medical treatment themselves. The question is raised whether or not that kind of legislation in at least two states violates the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. It is significant, of course, not only because of the importance of understanding how broad the 14th Amendment, that Equal Protection Clause, is, but also noting that the Sixth Circuit reversed a preliminary injunction of the District Court for the Middle District of Tennessee and the District Court for the Western District of Kentucky, and remanded the case back to the lower court for more action. All of this, then, is followed by the Supreme Court's review. And yes, indeed, that case, Scrametti is the name of the case. It is coming up for oral argument this coming Wednesday. The case is spelled Scrametti, a case scheduled for oral argument for our United States Supreme Court on Wednesday, December 4th. One of the first, if not the first, case addressing transgender issues, transgender rights in front of our Supreme Court. How are those consistent with, or perhaps inconsistent with, the 14th Amendment? All of that being argued. Of course, there's another case that's percolating up out there. It has not yet reached the Supreme Court, and it is another transgender case. This is the one under Title IX. It's the one that addresses whether or not Title IX has limitations on or opens avenues for transgender sports participants and other things in the educational area based upon transgender status of students. That's the academic side of the transgender issue. That case may well be among the future ones that the Supreme Court grants cert on sometime during this term. Again, it's decided that it's going to hear about 47 cases, probably has at least 13, 14, 15 more cases to fill its docket before it is completely done. But Scrametti, again, a major civil rights case, a major human rights case coming up for decision ultimately in May, June, July of next year. But for oral argument, where we'll get a pretty good sense from the Supreme Court justices about how they feel about transgender rights in America. And that also, you've got access to that by going into the Supreme Court docket and going online and listening to them argue that live this coming Wednesday morning. All that coming up in the Supreme Court as it takes up, as we know, many other cases out there. We talked already about this broadband case, the latest attack upon the so-called administrative state. We've talked previously about this ghost gun case, the regulation of ghost guns by the ATF, and the determination about whether or not that can stand. We'll talk more about other things on the docket of the Supreme Court as Amicus, a Law Review, continues.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home of Mino and the Mayor.
Do you know or work with kids who have special health care needs? Help them live their best lives. Contact Wisconsin Wayfinder Children's Resource Network. Our specialists will connect you with services in your area. Wisconsin Wayfinder is free and confidential. Call 877-947-2929 or visit dhs.wi.gov/wiscway. Connect today. sponsored by the Wisconsin Department of Health Services.
Christmas, when we were growing up, was different. It was about being hunkered down in your hometown and hearing the same stories Dad always told about Christmases past. While I like those traditions, I wanted something easier. This year, we're all meeting in Alexandria, Minnesota. The kids, their kids, card games, hot chocolate, all the outdoor fun, and oh, we'll still tell stories, but we'll also be making new stories, too.
Explore your holiday getaway options at explorealex.com.
97.9 WGBW and WGBW.FM.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
My name is Jim Santel. This is Amicus Law Review, reviewing the things that are on the docket of our highest court. Yes, very active court this month, next month, December, January, February, March, oral arguments scheduled on many, many different things, some of which we've discussed, some of those other cases for discussion in the future as they come up for oral argument. Again, major cases being decided by our United States Supreme Court in this term, likely to be issuing decisions in May, June, July of next year. The ghost gun case we talked about before, that's Garland versus Vanderstock, whether or not the ATF can regulate these kits that you can get through the mail, through deliveries from private providers, and assemble guns. Are those guns, are those firearms under the law? A major case as well involving other issues related to environment. The question of in a case involving San Francisco and the EPA, whether or not a combined sewer and stormwater system complies with something called the National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System and the rules and regulations imposed by the EPA upon the city of San Francisco. Some disagreements there between a major American city and the EPA about wastewater discharges into the Pacific Ocean that includes some identified pollutants. And that case also, again, on the docket of the Supreme Court, among its many other cases. That one also raising issues about whether or not a federal agency has the discretion, the authority to act as it has. We talked previously about this case involving Glossop versus Oklahoma, a defendant who is on death row. And in the wake of being placed on death row, the death penalty imposed upon him, discovery that the prosecution during the course of the underlying trial basically presented evidence of a witness who committed perjury and therefore denied the defendant a full and adequate opportunity to defend himself. Glossop versus Oklahoma, a major death penalty case, a case involving deceptive advertising involving cannabis medication, THCs, and CBD-based medications. That case is medical marijuana versus Horn. Not so much a medical marijuana case, but more of a deceptive practices case. Other cases involve questions of whether the federal government is authorized to license a private company, a private entity, to temporarily store spent nuclear waste at a location away from the nuclear plant at which that fuel was generated. That case involving the state of Texas, coming out of the Fifth Circuit, once again, that's involving another agency called the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. There's another case called Seven County Infrastructure Coalition versus Eagle County, Colorado. That's a mouthful. Basically, again, another environmental case questioning whether or not the National Environmental Policy Act, sometimes called NEPA, requires what we all know as environmental impact studies conducted by that federal agency. Can they extend beyond the proximate effects, the immediate effects of actions over which the regulatory authority is clear? Can they go beyond the specific assignment, the specific focus of the environmental impact study and discuss larger impacts? That also, there's a case called FDA versus Wager and White Lion Investments. And that is the name of the case, of course, that is the vaping case. It's coming up for oral argument just this week. A significant case in terms of not just the FDA, but also things in our commercial markets. A case called Stanley versus City of Sanford, Florida. Question about whether under the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, that a municipality can or cannot restrict some health insurance benefits for a retired city firefighter after a disclosure that she is suffering from Parkinson's disease. An important issue under the ADA. Some other cases involving free speech. This one's called Free Speech Coalition versus Paxton. Yes, again, That's the Paxton of the Attorney General of the state of Texas. Can a state legislature mandate that websites with content that, according to the state legislature, is harmful to minors, they're talking about pornography, can those websites be required by state law to verify the age of every user without running afoul of the free speech mandates of the First Amendment? Interesting issue. Also being faced by one of our nations overseas, which we'll get to later in this hour. And finally, another case among the 47, EMD Sales versus Carrera. This has to do with overtime pay. Is an employer of current and former grocery distributor employees, are they liable for violations of something called the Fair Labor Standards Act, the FLSA, for describing those employees, categorizing them as outside salesmen and outside saleswomen, and so refusing to compensate them on overtime pay, an employment issue? An employment issue, those among the many cases being discussed, being considered among the 47, almost certainly to go up to 60, maybe 62, maybe even more than that in this docket, this 2024-2025 docket of the United States Supreme Court. Now, reason why all of that is important is also that to the extent the government is involved in many of these cases, and they are, the environmental cases, certainly the guns cases, other cases involving civil rights and human rights, the Supreme Court has taken the position that the Solicitor General is the one who presents argument to the Supreme Court. Right now, her name is Elizabeth Preligar. We know that in the incoming administration, there will be a new Solicitor General. His name will certainly will be John Sauer. He's the one who successfully argued before the Supreme Court back in April of this past year that presidents have immunities for crimes committed in office. John Sauer is going to become the new Solicitor General arguing cases before the Supreme Court. And what is the point of all that? What's the point of discussing all these cases where there is significant controversy between the administration and other parties about what should happen? Well, the answer is that with the change in administration, not just the change in the Solicitor General, but also in the Department of Justice itself, the Solicitor General is one of the top officials of the United States Department of Justice, responsible to the Attorney General and the Deputy Attorney General. When John Sauer takes office, highly likely that the Solicitor General, through his office, the Department of Justice, through the Solicitor General, will tell the Supreme Court that we have changed our position, or more accurately, the administration has changed and the position of the Department of Justice on things like guns and civil rights and the environment has therefore changed as well. That will dramatically impact whether these cases go ahead, whether we in fact hear about opinions on these cases in June or July, or whether they are effectively mooted, effectively taken off the calendar by virtue of 180-degree changes in the position of the Department of Justice. The Solicitor General no longer advocating, for example, in support of the ATF rule prohibiting the selling of ghost guns in their non-assembled state. That will almost certainly change under the new administration. The rule that was imposed by the ATF almost certainly withdrawn and therefore no longer a case in controversy. Highly likely we'll not get a decision by the Supreme Court, but we will get, as a result of that change in administration in the Supreme Court, not only the withdrawal of that case and others that we have talked about, but also when it comes to those issues, a change in our nation with respect to guns, with respect to civil rights, with respect to the environment, and all sorts of other things out there that are among those 47 cases in which the government has an interest. That is the other reason why when you elect a president, you're not just electing the president's policies and practices and certainly the members of his or her cabinet, the other agency actions that may in fact be subject to that executive review. Not all of them are. But you're also having an impact upon the very ways in which decisions are made before the United States Supreme Court. With the change in administration come January 20th, many of these petitions, the arguments made up to this point, will change as well. As well, the ultimate decisions by the United States Supreme Court. No small impact here in our nation. As we continue, we're going to turn to other issues involving the rule of law on the face of our planet. Stay with us for that important discussion here on Amicus, a Law Review.
From Denmark to De Pere, this is 97.9 WGBW.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. President-elect Donald Trump announcing he plans to nominate loyalist Kash Patel to be the next director of the FBI.
Kash Patel is somebody who has made a name for himself as the ultimate Trump loyalist. This is the FBI director nominee for retribution, and you can bet that there will be a lot of pushback, certainly from Democrats, but I think you're going to see significant pushback from at least some Republicans as well.
ABC's Jonathan Carl. Lake effect snow blanketing parts of the U.S. during the busy holiday travel weekend. At least five states issuing winter alerts, with some parts of Pennsylvania, Ohio, and New York expecting to see as much as 6 feet of snow in the coming days. Stellantis CEO Carlos Tavares resigning today as the Jeep and Ram maker continues to struggle with waiting sales. Today, President Biden, First Lady Jill Biden marking World AIDS Day at the White House displaying the AIDS Memorial quilt. This is ABC News.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
Another win for Wisconsin. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Men's college basketball, the Wisconsin Badgers beat Chicago State 74-53 in Madison. Head coach Greg Gard says the Badgers improved as the game wore on.
We shot the ball better. Obviously, second half, you shoot 50% from three and get to the line a lot. And I always remind guys, no matter if you're getting 20 seconds or 39 minutes, make the most of it because they all add up.
The Badgers now 8-0. They host Michigan on Tuesday. NBA, the Bucks with a 124-114 victory over the Wizards. Bucks head coach Doc Rivers praised Damian Lillard and Giannis Antetokounmpo.
Thought Giannis and Dame down a stretch really played the two-man game, and through the two-man game, they made two great passes, one to Brooke, one to TP. A lot of good stuff to show our team to just keep us building.
Giannis finished the night with 42 points.
We know how to win games. We kept saying the same thing, like, doesn't matter, just win the game. We're going to go watch film and see what we can do better.
That's the Bucks' Giannis Antetokounmpo. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Mostly sunny to partly cloudy skies as a few flurries develop in the afternoon. Highs in the upper 20s and northwest winds gusting around 20 miles per hour. Flurry chances continue tonight. Partly cloudy skies and lows near 20.
It's 24 at our studios.
Max Inc. on Civic Media with Mike and Wendy from Sunspot.
Can you imagine the mosh pit on the bridge that could happen?
Oh, well, that's how the original series was when they moved the camera. Whenever it's like the red alert, the ear,
right?
Yeah, that was the mosh pit.
Yeah. And everybody had to like fake like
right, lean left, lean right.
Yeah.
Join us for all the fun with Max Inc. on Saturday nights, 6 to midnight, across the Civic Media Radio Network and on the Civic Media app.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
His name's Jeff Mandel, general counsel for Law Forward.
Mr. Gableman broke more ethics laws and rules than he followed. The attorney's oath here in Wisconsin is fairly long. Mr. Gableman had, in the course of the sham investigation into the 2020 election, violated every single sentence in that oath.
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekdays from 2 till 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
From the Lakeshore to Lake Winnebago.
Door to Fond du Lac counties.
Northeast Wisconsin is special for many different reasons. I'm Lisa Hale.
And I'm Terry Barr. Family and fun.
Safe communities and friends. We're featuring all of it as part of New Wisco Weekend, a news magazine show just for you, and highlighting what makes the Fox Valley and Green Bay area a great place to live.
Join us.
New Wisco Weekend, Saturday mornings at 8, Sundays at 11 on WGBW and WISS and the Civic Media app.
Are you prepared for an emergency or disaster? Because it's not a matter of if, but when. Don't find yourself saying,
when the storm rolls in, my time to find a pet-friendly evacuation center will have run out.
The scorching heat wave will leave me powerless to cool my insulin.
I'll face a hurricane without meds. Now that's a tough pill to swallow.
Let's prepare so we all have a better story to tell. Get started at ready.gov/olderadults. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Dom Selvia.
Just PS, Dom's producer here. Next time, Dom will be back live for all the political talk you missed. No more looking at how the sausage gets made, except for the government. Tune in.
The Dom Selvia Show, weekdays 4 till 6.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, your host for this remaining hour of our weekend broadcast. Always interested in your inquiries, your questions at 855-752-4842. And that includes Mark. Mark, you've been on the line for a while. Glad to have you with us as a part of our weekend discussion.
Yeah, thanks so much, Jim. Yeah, it puzzles me that our Supreme Court is looking at stuff, and I guess maybe I'm misunderstanding, but in Federalist 44, Madison points out that they didn't expressly put in the Constitution everything possible, the delegated powers that Congress might have to address the law. And I would think that could get passed over, that Congress can say that we have agencies now in the government that are going to be subject matter experts and able to address some of these issues, and that we don't need to, Congress itself doesn't need to attend to every single minute detail of what the law is and how the law is going to be carried out, that rely on subject matter experts to do some of that stuff, which gets to Chevron as well. But as far as for the president having these supreme powers now, it just baffles me how the Supreme Court was able to get around the fact that, repeatedly in the Federalist Papers, Madison, I was looking at it today, and Federalist 72 said, we're not going to have, or I think it, maybe got the number wrong, but that or 70, that we do not, the presidency is not going to be some oriental despot. And what he meant by oriental at that point, right, in the context of the time, was not some Persian Shah having, Janissaries at his disposal and, his personal harem. But with this president, he is talking about using the military as his force to express his will across the country. And Donald Trump has expressed in the past he could go on Fifth Avenue and just murder somebody, just kill somebody and get away with it. And with this Supreme Court, it is not beyond imagination anymore that Donald Trump could say, that guy is my enemy, so I, that I personally choose to, it's my part of my official duties to, to take out my enemy. And right, Donald Trump is the state. That is not what we want to have. Is the president is not the state. He's not a king.
He is one of three branches, right? That's exactly your point. And again, Mark, I know you've read it. Others have read it as well. As stunning as that immunity decision is back in July, which continues once again to animate what is and is not going on in our courts, those first few pages of it are these incredible words of commission to a very strong president that has got to be muscular, has got to be able to respond very quickly and definitively to actions. Cannot be bothered with things like criminal prosecutions, kinds of things that you're looking at even this morning in the Federalist Papers, Mark, all those kinds of things. That, the establishment, Mark, your point is the establishment of that supreme presidency, along with a Supreme Court that once again is more and more relying upon itself and not the expert background and experience in all these agencies. This latest case, again, involving Consumers Research, coming up for oral argument probably in the springtime, getting rid of yet another doctrine that, as you said at the outset, Mark, here, contemplated by Congress that there be delegations to agencies. Maybe we need to resurrect that non-delegation doctrine and say either Congress has got to say it or the agencies cannot do it. Once again, a great, great distrust in the agencies, even while we are advancing and promoting dramatically the power of the Supreme Court to make these calls and, as you said, at the same time, advancing this notion of a supreme presidency. Along the way, one wonders, where is the Congress, right? Where is the Congress that should be the ones who are making these decisions? They were going to be the major institution in the Federalist Papers and the Constitution that does all this. Mark, appreciate your comment, your inquiry, and your observation very much, as always, here on our Saturday and Sunday broadcast here on Amicus, a Law Review. It is not, of course, only in our nation where legislation gets passed or not passed from time to time that has a dramatic impact upon the citizenry. Let's do a couple of rule of law snapshots here, which we haven't done in a while. Two things coming from Australia and from Great Britain that are worth note and worth discussion in the future, not only in those nations and the legislatures of those nations, but issues related to things on our docket, in our agenda as well. Australia just this past week imposing legislatively a sweeping ban on social media for children under the age of 16. And again, this is one of the significant aspects of this. It is one of the most comprehensive measures aimed at so-called safeguarding young people from potential hazards online. And the law sets a minimum age, again, for users of platforms like TikTok and Instagram and X, for example. The issue now is how this restriction will be enforced. That's the big question, how it's going to be enforced on a day-to-day basis. The law, the prime minister who is supporting it, his name is Anthony Albanese, has said it puts Australia at the vanguard of efforts to protect the mental health and well-being of children from detrimental effects of social media, such as online hate or bullying. And certainly that happens a lot, as we all know, on these online formats, these online platforms. An attempt to keep our children, at least the Australian children, safe and secure at a time when they, in fact, are in their developmental stages. The law, the prime minister said, puts the onus on social media platforms to take what are called reasonable steps to prevent anyone under 16 from having an account off completely. Corporations could be fined up to $49.5 million Australian dollars. That's about $31, $32 million in our system for systemic failures to implement age requirements. The law goes on to say that plainly the underage users, neither they nor their parents will face punishment for the violations. It places the burden once again of enforcement compliance upon the platform providers themselves. Interestingly, France last year passed a law requiring parental consent for social media users under 15. And it has been pushing for some similar measures like things across the European Union in that part of the world. Florida, this past year, as you know, as we've talked, imposed a ban for users under 14 requiring parental consent for 14 and 15-year-olds. That law, plainly the subject of an awful lot of challenge out there. But in Australia, barring everyone under 16 from social media, period, and now raising the question about enforcement. The purposes behind it, probably legitimate, although not without challenges, plainly, in their courts as that particular legislative piece goes ahead. It is one of those things that underscores the importance for courts and for legislatures and even for executives like the prime minister and presidents across the globe to address these issues in an evolving situation. Also underscores, of course, the notion that constitutions, whether they're Australian or American or in other nations, even systems of laws, have got to be alive. They've got to be responding to the times in which the issues are raised. Cannot be premised upon the history and tradition of society, because those do not give you an awful lot of guidance, especially when it comes to something like safeguarding young people, again, from so-called potential hazards online. Things like X and Instagram and TikTok, Twitter, that people like James Madison could never have imagined to begin with. That happening in Australia and then in Great Britain. Lawmakers again, this time, of course, in Parliament. After a very, very emotional, times impassioned debate on Friday of just this past week, voted to do something dramatic. Sometimes compared to Britain's legalization of abortion in 1967, the abolition of the death penalty there in 1969, being compared to significant changes of that dimension, what did Britain's lawmakers do? They voted to allow assisted dying for terminally ill patients there in that nation, England and Wales, under some strict conditions. And again, establishing one of the most profound social changes in that country in decades. The vote inside the parliament, 330 to 279. So you've got a split parliament there. Members of the parliament in the end giving their support that would permit doctors to help some terminally ill patients to end their lives. Now, the process there in their parliamentary system, like ours in many ways, this is not the final say on the matter. All of this will have to now go to some parliamentary committees and amendments to the bill, maybe put forward. But it nonetheless is a significant movement in this direction. The new legislation, as it is currently written, applies to a very narrow group. It's applicants who are over 18. You have to be an adult. You've got to be diagnosed with a terminal illness, and you have to have been given no more than 6 months to live. Two doctors and a judge would be required to give their approval, And the fatal drugs would have to be self-administered. So a lot of safeguards in that area. But an important piece of legislation, importantly, again, as we look around the globe, assisted dying is already legal in a handful of European countries. And that includes, among other countries outside of Europe, Canada and New Zealand. And here in America, 10 states and the District of Columbia also have assisted dying legislation. All of that, again, proposed by the Labour Party there in Great Britain. And lawmakers, again, appropriately being given by their parties freedom to vote with their consciences instead of expecting to be voting along party lines according to their particular dictates of their own conscience. That's what the leaders of the parties there in Parliament contemplated. 5 hours of debate on Friday, crowded parliamentary chamber, raw divisions, lots of emotion over an issue that transcended political affiliations and will again change the social fabric, undeniably, of Great Britain if indeed the law goes forward. It has hurdled this major, major step already in Great Britain. Lawmakers voting to legalize assisted dying in this major legislative move just this past week. Those things happening, the rule of law, certainly not the last comments, not the last words on those issues in those nations, certainly not in our nation as well. And so let us return to the United States of America for a couple more things that happened just in recent days and weeks here in the United States of America. Texas, which again gives rise to an awful lot of those federal cases now pending before the Supreme Court. Texas, of course, right there in the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. Texas, this past week, its curriculum group, on Friday, approved a revolutionary new elementary school curriculum that is premised principally upon the Bible. And this, of course, is a major step in this contentious argument there in Texas and now spreading around the country. Oklahoma has similar arguments and disagreements and discussions going on to expand the scope of religion instruction in the state. This particular education policy that was adopted on Friday, the reading and language arts curriculum, which is where it's found, is going to be optional for schools, but it could serve plainly as a model for others throughout other states. Its approval, once again, as I just mentioned, comes as Oklahoma superintendent, you know this well, seeking to compel all educators in that state to teach from the Bible. Also, not too far away, Louisiana has fights in its courts to require the Ten Commandments be displayed in classrooms. Now, we know well what the law is in America. Way back in 1963, the United States Supreme Court said you cannot have religious instruction in public schools. Private schools, entirely appropriate, entirely within their discretion to do what they want. Public schools, that's government. And again, cannot establish a religion. This comes from the First Amendment to the Constitution. No establishment of religion in schools, which includes government, of course. The other portion of the religious phrase, that a religious doctrine there is, you can't affect the exercise, can't impinge upon the exercise of religion in America. But this is a question of whether or not you are establishing a religion in a public setting. In 1963, the Supreme Court said, nope, cannot stand in front of a class and teach from the Bible. Cannot do that. Now, people say often, well, gee, you've prohibited any sort of Bible references or uses in schools. And the answer is no. Supreme Court has been equally clear that you can indeed read the Bible privately. You can pensively in a study hall, other circumstances, have a Bible with you as a student. You cannot teach from it. You cannot teach in a religious type format directly from the Bible itself. Bible-based lessons are unconstitutional. And yet now we have in Texas, arguably in Oklahoma, arguably in Louisiana, other places around the country, this pushback and attempt perhaps to revisit this issue once again under the First Amendment. When we come back, we'll talk more about Bible-based lessons for public schools here on Amicus, a Law Review.
This is the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW. Hey there, it's Carrie Joy with your Work Money Minute and an answer to the question, how often should I take my car in to get it serviced? As somebody who's worked on cars and knows a little bit about them, I admit that my instincts here are 100% wrong. I always want to say, oh, I'll just know when it's time. I'll feel it. But that's pretty hard to make a plan or a budget around. And my husband has made an honest car owner out of me by scheduling our maintenance on the calendar according to the book that everybody has and nobody reads, the manual in your glove compartment. Yep, even the motorheads over at cartalk.com. Remember that old Car Talk radio show that was one of my favorites, you know, with Click and Clack, the Tappet Brothers? They say that taking your car in on the schedule dictated by the people who made it is the best way to keep it in shape. So grab that manual. And if you want more tips on saving, head over to workmoney.org. Till next time, I'm Carrie Joy saying take good care.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for Nightlight with Peach Schwabba.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel, and we are talking in this, the final segment of our weekend broadcast, about things going on here in the United States of America, specifically in states like Texas, other places in our nation, attempting to roll back what has been the law since 1963 in America, and that is you do not teach in public schools directly from Bibles. And again, in Texas, the final approval just this past week by their curriculum board, finding that indeed this curriculum that is for kindergarten through fifth grade available to districts, it will serve about, the state serves about 2 million elementary students in public schools. What does the curriculum do? It incorporates into English lessons stories from the Bible, such as Jesus and his Sermon on the Mount, the parable of the prodigal son, and the Old Testament tale of Esther. Now, what can you do and what can you not do? Well, once again, you cannot stand in front of a class and say we're going to be teaching from the Bible itself. But you can indeed teach, for example, the history of religion on the face of the planet. You can talk about any of the major, even some of the minor religions that have animated the history of human civilization. That, of course, includes not only Christianity, but Judaism and Islam and Sikhism and Hinduism and Buddhism and many, many others, Jainism, many, many other very well-established religions. You can talk about the history of religion, make that not only a history course, but also describe where those religions come from, what some of their principal tenets are, those kinds of things, without what's called proselytizing. You cannot encourage students to become adherents to a particular faith. On Friday in Texas, the Texas State Board of Education approved this curriculum in a narrow 8-7 vote, three Republicans joining four Democrats on that board in an effort to reject it, but nonetheless it's successful. The state's individual districts and the schools will ultimately decide which materials to teach, but they are financially incentivized. They're encouraged by this program to adopt curriculums that are specifically approved by this board. Needless to say, causing a huge amount of discussion there, igniting a fierce backlash, hundreds of Texans protesting for months at meetings of the State Board of Education in advance of this voting. And the state's largest teachers union, many parents, including Christians, arguing the lessons blur this constitutional distinction. They blur the distinction between instruction on religion and proselytizing, and present scriptures, as they say, as factual truth to children as young as five. That going on now in Texas, again, lots of things to consider there, and plainly a rising, encouraging, rising argument, ultimately probably geared toward returning to the Supreme Court one day and determining whether or not that 1963 prohibition and like prohibitions that followed, including the prohibition on posting the Tenth Commandments in places of public instruction and places of public industry and commerce, that also a part of the constitutional history of our nation that remains the law to this day, probably an attempt by these various groups in Texas, other places like Louisiana, like Oklahoma, an attempt to begin to move in the direction of seeing if we can overturn that longstanding tradition of now well over 40 years or so. Interesting intellectually, interesting constitutional issue under the First Amendment. And of course, the Supreme Court in the past, as we have talked, is very interested, has always been interested in recent terms in this issue, not only of establishment of religion, but also the free exercise of religion. John Roberts, the Chief Justice, being at the forefront of this change in the way in which we evaluate whether or not the legislation of a particular state or by the Congress is establishing religion. An action is somehow impinging upon that establishment principle, or also impinging upon the right to exercise religion freely. The Chief Justice more and more beginning to articulate a standard that says if the provision, if the legislation in some way discriminates against or affects in some way negatively a religion, that is prohibited by the First Amendment. Interesting times, interesting applications of the First Amendment. This one, once again, plainly pushing the limits on what the First Amendment does and does not say in contemporary America. We'll continue to look at those cases as they go forward. And finally, here on our weekend broadcast, some notations about other things going on in America. Major indication that white supremacist incidents are rising again across the United States of America. Things called flash demonstrations that are intended to spread fear and anxiety, happening almost weekly by a number of different groups reporting on these things. Again, fairly recently, they've always been out there, but an increase of dramatic dimension. The Anti-Defamation League has recently reported about 282 events organized or attended by white supremacists in 2023 alone. That's a 63% increase from the 173 recorded in 2022. In 2024, this year, from Memorial Day to Labor Day, there were 64 white supremacist activities in 25 different states, according to, again, this Center on Extremism, also supported by other groups that are also monitoring this kind of thing. Those included what are called fight nights, mixed martial arts style events held for supporters to socialize and recruit members and raise money, all for their racist and their otherwise inappropriate advocacies. The experts who are monitoring this describe this according to some familiar patterns. They say small groups of mostly masked men chant, and they sometimes wave swastikas, white power flags in public. They yell racial slurs at targets. Those targets, of course, are varied. They're diverse. They're immigrants. They're members of our Black community, the Hispanic community, people of color, Jews, LGBT community members. The activities, again, of these relatively small but unidentified, at least individually, groups, they unfurl some offensive banners with epithets about those groups. They do them over highways. They post racist flyers in communities. And the demonstrations are typically also captured on video. And the purpose for that, according to these groups that are monitoring this, is for purposes of recruiting more, to further raise money, to recruit members, to socialize among these groups. They ricochet sort of across social media to larger audiences, even though the groups themselves may not be that large in the particulars. For example, a neo-Nazi group scattered flyers across lawns and doorsteps in three Waterloo, Ohio neighborhoods just before Veterans Day this past year. The handouts offered a chilling assessment of the group's proximity. In capillaries, they said this: "We are your neighbors. We are the random stranger holding the door open for you. We are everywhere." Very disturbing reporting coming out of reporting on white supremacist incidents across our nation. Next week, more of that, more of reporting on what's going on in America of 2024 as we look
from Ashwaubenon to Alloway. This is 97.9 WGBW. Todd Albaugh.
Hey, everybody, join us next time, an all-new live show back in the studio. Join us for a look back at the holiday weekend and prepare you for the week ahead.
The Todd Albaugh Show, weekdays noon till 2.
Here's another great reason to use the United States Postal Service this season. When sending a package, why venture outside? Ship with USPS for a true holiday ride.
Want to stay cozy and warm? There's no need to roam. With free package pickup and labels printed from home, we have over 600,000 employees always in motion. And before you know it, your gift has delivered emotion. Spread the holiday joy this season with USPS's enhanced network. Learn more at usps.com/holidayride.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
This is 97.9 WGBW Denmark, Green Bay's real news and great conversation, a Civic Media radio station.